I talked with a person who has been a secretary of a supper club, who has for the last 30 years engaged professional speakers to appear at these clubs and address groups. And he indicated that he had heard perhaps 500 to 600 speakers over the last 30 years, and that our next speaker ranks among the top two of those 500 to 600 speakers. We welcome with great anticipation and pleasure Vernon Grimwood.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Judge Limbaugh, honored guests, ladies and gentlemen, thank you for that kind introduction. I'll never forget the shortest introduction I ever received in my life. One time back in my home state of Kansas, an old farmer got up and said, "Friends, I've been asked to introduce Vernon Grimsley, who's going to make a speech to us." He stood there and thought for a minute, said, "Well, I have now done so, and he will now do so." And he sat down. Most confused introduction I ever received. One time, Master of Ceremonies introduced me, among other things, as a man who just made $400,000 on a big oil deal in Oklahoma. That was not entirely accurate. First of all, it wasn't an oil deal. It was real estate. It wasn't in Oklahoma. It was in Texas. It wasn't $400,000 either. It was $400. And it wasn't a profit. It was a loss. But other than that, he had it right. I remember the first speech I ever gave to a Grange Association. Afterward, a farmer's wife came up to me and said, "You were certainly better than the speaker we had last month." I said, "Thank you very much." She said, "Yeah, he talked for an hour and a half. He didn't say anything." She said, "You didn't say anything either, but you only took 35 minutes. One time we were on a program that was running slow or a little behind. I went up to the Master of Ceremonies. I said, "Don't tell my whole life story. It'd be better if you say less about me so we can expedite the program." Master of Ceremonies came up and said, "Our next speaker is Vernon Benham Grimsley. The less said about him, the better." And he said, I fly all over the United States giving speeches, and air travel is so impressive. Last week, I had breakfast in New York, lunch in Chicago, supper in San Francisco. I would have been more impressed, except my luggage ended up in Dubuque, Iowa. I went up to the United Airlines ticket counter one time. I had three bags. I said, "I want you to send this bag to New Orleans, Louisiana, this bag to Buffalo, New York, and this bag to Los Angeles." They said, "We can't do that." I said, "I don't know why not. You did it last week." One time I addressed a women's garden club, and at the conclusion, Secretary Treasurer brought me up a check. I said, "I can't accept a check for addressing as a young, growing organization. Let me return it to you." She said, "Wonderful," said, "I'll put it in our special fund." I said, "Good, what's the special fund for?" She said, "That's so we can afford to hire better speakers next year." One night I was out traveling across the country, checked into a hotel. It was late after midnight. Five pieces of luggage. The night bellman helped me up to my room. I reached in my pocket to give him a tip. All in the world I had was a $50 bill, which he couldn't break, and 13 cents in change. I said, "I can't give you just 13 cents as a tip. That would be an insult." But I said, "Tell you what I can do. I'll reach down in my briefcase here. I'll take out one of the inspirational, motivational, psychological, philosophical cassettes that I've recorded. I'll autograph it to you and give it to you personally." He stood there and looked at me for a minute. He said, "If it's all the same to you, I'll take the 13 cents. A fellow woke up in a jail cell one morning, hungover, felt terrible, mouth tasted like the inside of a jogging shoe, yelled out to the jailkeeper, said, "What am I here for?" The jailer said, "You're here for drinking." The man brightened up, said, "It's all right by me, let's get started." That's what I say this morning, let's get started. And at the conclusion of my address, whether you emerge inspired or whether you awaken refreshed, we will at least have considered some of the great ideas in motivational psychology. Young man graduated from college, standing there with his cap and gown, mortarboard, tassel hanging over his left eye, talking with his parents. He said, "Well, my grades weren't the best." He said, "In fact, I wasn't even in the top half of the class." But he said, "I was in the half that made the top half possible." Little boy standing out on a grade school playground. Over his right shoulder, he has a baseball bat. In his left hand, he has a baseball. Throws the baseball up in the air, takes a mighty swing at it. Misses, yells, "Strike one." Throws it up again. Misses, says, "Strike two." Throws it up again. Misses the third time, says, "Strike three, I'm out." Another little boy been standing there watching him. Says, "You're not much of a hitter, are you?" He says, "No, but I'm a pretty good pitcher, don't you think?" When we lose a client or we lose a case, we have to maintain a philosophy and a sense of humor. The past is irretrievably gone. We cannot bring back a single moment of the past. And the future is not yet here. All we possess is this present moment. We read in the newspapers, hear on radio and television about the great global energy crisis. And yet, in my conviction, the greatest energy waste on this planet is the energy men and women waste, feeling sorry for themselves, self-pity, worry, fear, anxiety. The great energy crisis on this earth is the spiritual and philosophic energy crisis. Because human beings were not created to grow old. We get old when we stop growing. Each one of us ought to be not just a human being, but a human becoming. A human becoming what is our potential to be. A couple of years ago, I was flying into Boston to speak at Harvard University and do some broadcasts there. I'm sitting next to a young man, most pessimistic person I ever met in my life. He said, I don't think my life's ever going to succeed. Don't think my business is going to succeed. Don't think I'll ever be happy, fulfilled. I interrupted him. I said, wait a minute. He says, you shouldn't even talk that way. I said, you should be positive. He said, all right, I'm positive my life's never going to succeed. My business is going to succeed. It's true. In the study of psychology, we learn. You have to attend carefully to the thoughts you think and the words you speak, because with the thoughts you think and the words you speak, you are programming your mind as certainly as you'd program a computer. The human brain is the greatest computer ever designed on earth and produced entirely by unskilled labor. Think of that. I was talking to Dr. Charles Brackett, great neurosurgeon, on one occasion. I said, in psychology, we've used that statistic so long. Most people in their lifetimes use only about 10% of their mental capacity. Do you think that's accurate? He said, that's a vast overestimate. He said, the majority of people don't use 10%, far less than that. That's like living in one tiny broom closet of a great, huge mansion. There's so much more to learn and explore. These lights in here run on electricity. Big truck runs on diesel fuel. Car runs on gasoline. Our human bodies run on food, but the mind runs on ideas. And the kinds of ideas we put into our minds make all the difference in the world. With this great knowledge explosion of the 1980s, the greatest problem we have is not the problem of what we don't know. It's the problem of what we don't do with what we do know. The Sioux Indians believe the word choice is a sacred word. They consider it holy in their vocabulary, that scepter of sovereignty by which we decide what we're going to do with our lives. Plato, the ancient Greek philosopher, said, take charge of your thoughts. You can do what you will with them. I once watched a great black educator standing in front of a junior high school classroom, largely black and Hispanic young people, and he said, most of you have been told you're never going to amount to anything. You don't believe much in yourself. But he said, I'm here to tell you, you can be somebody if you'll begin to believe in yourself. He said, some of you can be doctors, lawyers, nurses, judges, educators. But he said, it all begins in your mind, your heart, your soul. He said, I'm going to teach you this morning 10 words that can totally change your life. He said, these aren't long words, only two letters in each one of these words, about as short as a word can be. He said, they can change your life. He said, I want you to repeat, if it is to be, it is up to me. And they repeated, if it is to be, it is up to me. He said, no, put some enthusiasm, put some heart and some soul into that. And he got them chanting it over and over again. If it is to be, it is up to me. If it is to be, it is up to me. And I saw a dawning in their faces, in their eyes. Some of them, perhaps for the first time in their lives, the realization they could make something of their lives. They understood that it begins in the inner life. The task for each one of us is not to see the legal profession as it is, but see it as it could be. Not just to see our careers, our lives, the world as they are, but as they could become. Psychology knows each one of us here is going to be essentially the same 1 year from this morning, 5 years from this morning, except for a very few things. The new books we read, new people we meet, cassettes we listen to, radio, television, and our inner lives of contemplation. And we have conscious control over the majority of these things. Psychology knows the human mind, once it has been expanded by some great idea, never again returns to its original shape and dimension. And if at this 104th meeting of the Missouri Bar, we come away with just one or two new ideas, they can permanently change our lives and our professions. We know the ways we can improve ourselves, read articles all the time. Physically, we can improve ourselves by exercise, good diet, nutrition, this sort of thing. Mentally, we know that psychology has found we can take charge of our lives by belief, expectation, repetition, and spiritually, faith, hope, and love. But furthermore, these things can become habitual to us. You know, if you've kept your wastebasket on the right side of your desk for years, for some reason the law partner, secretary, somebody decides to switch it over to the left side of your desk, you're going to keep throwing waste paper over on the right side just out of habit. When 1982 became 1983, how many of us continued writing 1982 on our checks and letters for a while? Didn't take us long, just 1 year to habituate ourselves to that. 1 year was enough. just attending a meeting of the State Bar Association, not enough to make us a better attorney, any more than wandering into a bakery will make us a muffin, or going into a garage, turn us into a car. We have to assimilate, learn, actually assimilate these things. There's a profound psychological tendency of what you think about will come about. As it is written in the scriptures, as a man thinketh in his heart, so is he. And then even when tragedy strikes, we learn not to focus on what we have lost, but on what we have left. The challenge for each one of us is not to be the best, but to be the best that we can be. Socrates, the ancient Greek philosopher, if you asked him a question, what would he do? Give an answer? No. Socrates asked you a question, then another, the Socratic method. Till finally you or I began to come up with the answer, because Socrates knew the average person possesses the potential to think more philosophically than he does. And it's the bringing forth of these untapped potentials which is the greatest challenge and adventure of human life. Mae West, great actress, once said, "Too much of a good thing is wonderful." Oh, we literally cannot get too much of the really good things, the great things of life. But the really good things are not just material, not power, wealth, and fame alone, but they're inner things, spiritual things, faith and hope, love. Last week, I gave an address in Washington, D.C., and knowing that this morning I was going to be speaking before the Missouri Bar Association, I went over to our great Supreme Court building for whatever perspective or inspiration I could derive, and it was there I read the words written in 1913 of Justice Oliver Wendell Holmes, writing of the Supreme Court. "We are very quiet here." But he said, "It is the quiet at the center of a storm." And so it is that in every great man or woman's life, regardless of how active, how stormy, how tempestuous it may be, the very center, there is a place of quiet, a philosophic contemplation, an inner citadel of the spirit. And in that great Supreme Courtroom itself, there are these huge marble panelings depicting in statues, on the one side, the powers of evil, corruption, slander, deceit, despotic power. And over on the other side, the powers of good, peace, harmony, liberty, justice, philosophy, truth, wisdom, and divine inspiration. And it is only when we view the profession of the law from this highest concept, realize that it is literally the human arena in which the great battle for good versus evil is being waged, that we understand what Abraham Lincoln meant in the year 1850 when he addressed that group of young attorneys. And he said, "A lawyer has a particular privilege of being a good person and bringing good into human affairs and into human life because," he said, "a lawyer can serve as a reconciler and as a peacemaker." And he quoted from the Sermon on the Mount, "Blessed are the peacemakers, for they shall be called the children of God." I once talked with an old Jewish rabbi who'd lost his entire family, all his relatives, in the anti-Semitic Hitlerian persecutions of World War II. Imagine how that would have felt. And he said he was so filled with anger for years, but he began getting ulcers and heart trouble. Finally went into synagogue and said, he threw himself down on the floor and he said, "God, if you'd given me two lives to live, I'd live one life in vengeance and hatred. I'd live the other life in love and mercy. But," he said, "you've only given me one life to live. Therefore, to live it in love." He said it was the greatest change ever came in his life. I think the greatest thing the philosopher Immanuel Kant ever said was, "Human beings were created to love people and use things, not to use people and love things." He even says in the scriptures we're supposed to love our enemies. I say, just for practice, why don't we try it out on our friends from time to time? A friend of mine, Cabot Robert, great attorney, was working with Tom Dewey in New York, cleaning up the rackets years ago. He said one day Tom Dewey came into the office and he said, "Everybody get your hats and coats. We're going to go down to the Bar Association. We've got Will Rogers coming in to give us a speech this noon at lunch." So they all went down there. They had lunch and introduced Will Rogers. And he stood up and he said, "I don't have a prepared speech for you, but I'm going to talk straight from my heart." Rogers said, "We're going to tell you what the greatest thing in life is." He said, "The greatest thing in the world is love." He said, "Now some of you fancy New York attorneys with three-piece suits on, you're going to think I'm a sissy." He said, at this point, Rogers grabbed a chair, jumped up on top of the chair, said, "I can lick any man in the house." And he could. He was a cowboy. But he said, "I still say love is the greatest thing in the world." And it was only 2 weeks later when Will Rogers, with his pilot, Wiley Post, was killed in that plane crash. Some say love, it is a river, and it drowns the tender reed. Some say love, it is a razor, it will leave your soul to bleed. Some say love, it is a hunger,
an endless aching need, but I say love is a flower, and you its only seed. It's the heart afraid of breaking that never learns to dance. It's the dream afraid of waking that never takes the chance. It's the one who won't be taken who never seems to give. And it's the soul afraid of dying that never learns to live. But when the night has been too lonely and the road has been too long, and you think that love is only for the lucky and the strong, just remember, in the winter far beneath the bitter snows, lies the seed that with the sun's love in the spring becomes the rose. Because a bell isn't a bell till you ring it, a song isn't a song till you sing it, and the love that's in you wasn't put there to stay, because love isn't love till you give it away. If we heard on radio and television a great meteorite or asteroid was plunging toward the world, the entire planet was going to be destroyed. All around the perimeter of this earth, telephone booths would be jammed full of people trying to call each other up one more time just to say, I love you, because that's at the very heart of truly exuberant living. All right, now let's get serious. How many of you men in here part your hair on the left-hand side? I recently read, don't be bashful, I read a Barber College study that in the United States of America, the majority of men, the vast majority, part their hair on the left-hand side. They got curious about it, so they did a follow-up study to find out why. You know why the majority of men in the United States part their hair on the left-hand side? It's because most mothers are right-handed. It's true. They found a mother stands a little boy up in front of her, wets the comb, takes a comb in her right hand, and parts his hair on her right, his left. And 40 years later, you ask the same man, why do you part your hair on the left-hand side? He says, that's where my part is. That's where it's always been. Men, next time you shower in shampoo, I say launch forth into the bold frontiers of tonsorial innovation. Reach up there, part your hair up on the other side. You'll feel better for it. Somebody says that's ridiculous. Well, of course it is. That's trivial. I picked a trivial example for an important point. We get programmed into so much of our behavior, and we don't even stop to analyze. We can change it. Say, I'm always grouchy till I've had my third cup of coffee. That's because Uncle Harry was always grouchy till he had it. It becomes then a self-fulfilling prophecy, but we can break that. One of the most exciting evenings I ever had, Scottsbluff, Nebraska, invited me in to give a speech for the Chamber of Commerce, and I was sitting next to a woman in her 60s. We began to talk. It was fascinating. Now, she was the widow of an attorney, as it turned out. She said they'd had a wonderful marriage, wonderful life, and now the children were married and gone. And she said she realized she had to decide what she was going to do with the rest of her life. So one morning, she unplugged the telephone after breakfast, made a big pot of coffee, sat down with one of those legal notepads, yellow notepads, and she started making a list. She thought back to everything she'd ever wanted to do, from her earliest girlhood through the middle years of life, right to the present, any project that had ever really fascinated her, and she wrote it all down. Then she prayed that she could become everything it was within her capability as a woman to become. It took her all morning to do the project. Well, the first thing on the list, I remember she told me, was learning how to swim. She'd always been afraid of water. She said, no more of that. So she went out and got swimming lessons. She started taking art classes. She always wouldn't know how to type. She went out and took typing classes at college. But there was a side benefit, because she said being around all those young people was a stimulus and a tonic to her health. She got a job with her newly acquired typing skills out of that college. I'll only mention one more thing. She'd always been fascinated by the story of Amelia Earhart. And she went out to the flying field, got somebody to teach her how to fly, and she's now known at that college as the flying grandmother of Scott's Bluff. One of the most exuberant people I've ever met. It all begins if you simply take a notepad and start writing down great worthy projects. Most people spend most of their time dreaming about the very things they could be doing if only they didn't spend most of their time dreaming about those things. In my study of psychology, what's always fascinated me is not what makes people tick. No, I want to find out how to wind people up. Some people say, are you a shrink? I say, no, I'm a stretch. The expanding of the borders of what we can do. That old Oriental proverb, give a man a fish, he eats for a day. Teach that man to fish and eats for a lifetime. It's learning these great self-sustaining projects. If I took a microphone and a video camera down to some shopping mall, even the one here connected to the hotel, if I interviewed 2,000 people and asked them, what's the great purpose of your life? I wonder if I'd find more than just two or three who had some clear, burning vision of the purpose of their lives. That old story, a man walking along down the street, he sees two men working, walks up to one of them, says, what are you doing? He says, I'm laying bricks at union wages in time and a half for overtime. Because the other one says, what are you doing? Gets a faraway, misty, mystical look in his eye. Says, I'm constructing a huge cathedral whose spires will reach to heaven. It will be a significant aspect of the spiritual life of this community. He lost his job. He was supposed to be building a filling station. We know that. But to see the great purpose makes all the difference in the world. A young journalist was once interviewing George Bernard Shaw, famous Irish author. Journalist said, Mr. Shaw, you've written so many books. Why is it you've never written your own autobiography? Shaw said, I've never written my own autobiography because things don't happen to me. Journalist said, things don't happen to you. He says, no, I happen to things. An old judge said, there's three kinds of people in the legal profession. Those who don't know what's happening, those who just watch what happens. And third, those who actually make things happen. Of those who don't know what's happening, they don't even burn the candle at one end. The second category, those who just watch what happens, you bring them in to give a speech like this, they'd be staring at me like a tree full of owls, like a pool of carp, like the RCA dog, you know. These are people who suffer from the paralysis of analysis. Some of these people can brighten up a room just by walking out of it. These are the individuals who stand by the great revolving door of achievement, waiting to get through on somebody else's push. Like a fellow hadn't kissed his wife for 30 years and then shot the man who did. As I look ahead to the remainder of the decade before us, my great concern is not the wild and loud harangue of the wicked people, nor the deafening silence of all the good people, just standing there watching, like that old farmer standing out in his field holding in his hand a piece of rope, and in his bewilderment unable to ascertain and determine whether he just found a rope or lost a cow. Some of these people aren't certain whether they've lost their meaningful direction in life or just found another aspect of apathy. Now, what makes a difference is motivation. A young junior partner in a law firm gets his paycheck one month. The senior partner has scribbled across the top of it, you are going to receive a raise. The young man gets all excited. He looks scribbled across the bottom of the check and says, the raise will become effective when you do. Now, I saw a great cartoon show that tramp lying on the side of a road, about a five-day growth of beard, tattered clothes. He looks up and there's a Rolls Royce going by, a millionaire driving it. And the caption of the tramp is thinking to himself, there, but for me, go I. The kind of people who don't know what's happening, those who just watch what happens. Third, the great and luminous souls actually make things happen. These aren't just the go-getters, these are the go-givers. They're possessed of a great service motivation in their lives. As Kettering said, I don't want a man who just has a job. I want a person whom the job has, who really enjoys the process. These are the people who never sacrifice the ultimate for the immediate. They know that truth is whole and fragmentation is error. These are the people who pray every morning, Lord, don't let me die until I'm dead. They don't want that zest and that inner fire to perish. And these are positive people in any profession. My old grandfather, for years, he was mayor of Emporia, Kansas. My grandfather said to me before he died, couldn't say it to me after he died, come to think of it. My grandfather said, Bernie, said, be a positive person. Don't go around telling people your troubles. He said, 90% of them couldn't care less one way or the other about your troubles. He said, the other 10% actually be glad to hear you finally getting what you deserve so many years. He said, no, I'll live rather by the philosophy of Invictus by William Ernest Henley. Dark as the night that covers me, black as the pit from pole to pole, I thank whatever gods may be for my unconquerable soul. It matters not how straight the gate, how charged with punishment the scroll. I am the master of my fate. I am the captain of my soul. Man went into a fancy French restaurant, ordered a lobster. 45 minutes later, the waiter brought the lobster. Man looked down and had a claw missing, only one claw. He calls the waiter back and says, the claw is the best part. The waiter looked down and said, well, must have gotten in a fight in the tank. Man said, well, take this one back and bring me the winner. For those possessed of a victorious attitude, not the person who never loses a client, never loses a case, no, but who has the attitude to keep coming back time and time again. The 49ers, when they came west, the Californians said they were a great, a strong, and a hardy people. Why? Because the cowards stayed at home and the weak died on the way. And those who arrived were tough. A stream of water in and of itself possesses no great power, but if you throw an obstacle across it, a dam, you can back up this water so you can turn turbines and dynamos with it. In the same way, an obstacle in a person's life. In the middle years, young years, late years, for example, oftentimes it's the obstacle of a person feeling frustrated by mandatory retirement. They give you a gold watch, list you in who's through in America. A and parole you to your wife. And so at that point, a person has a choice whether he's going to wear out or going to rust out, whether they're going to kill time or work it to death. But the real greats are the ones who know the road to achievement is always under construction, that life is not just a destination, it's a journey. And they know that just as genetically a huge oak tree is contained in a tiny acorn, so that it is in the mind of the individual that the future is contained. If we reach for the stars, we may not touch the stars. At least we will not come up with a handful of mud. People do not fail because they plan to fail. People fail because they fail to plan, because they do not do what that great woman in Scott's Bluff did. Actually sit down and decide what they're going to do with the remainder of their lives. Dr. Carl Menninger, famed psychiatrist, was asked what's necessary to be a success in a profession. He said three things. You have to know what you're doing, have to love what you're doing, and you have to believe in what you're doing. Man drove his car into a mechanic, had a knock on the engine. The mechanic leaned over, listened to it for a minute, took his wrench, tapped three times on the engine, knock vanished, it was purring like a tiger. The man said, how much do I owe you? The mechanic said, I'll be $10.10. He said, would you mind breaking that bill down for me? He said, no, not at all. He said, it's 10 cents for knocking three times on your engine with my wrench. He said, it was $10 for knowing where and how to knock three times on your engine with my wrench. Yes, those who succeed in the legal profession know what they're doing, love what they're doing, believe in what they're doing, and they have a great service motivation. There's a French proverb, hundreds of years old, about a little cupbearer to the king. Went out wandering in the woods one afternoon, and there he encountered a huge genie, appeared before him and said, I've been empowered to grant you any wish you desire, one wish. But he said, think carefully, because it is an irrevocable wish. It cannot be revoked. And the cupbearer said, oh, I know what I want. He said, I've spent my entire life waiting on other people, serving other people. He said, I want from now on everybody to have to wait on me and serve me. The genie said, your wish is granted. Cupbearer went back toward the castle. Somebody ran over and opened the door for him. He went to get the cup to take it to the king. Somebody else got the cup. Anything he wanted done was immediately done for him. Every wish was somebody's command. And for the first month, it was kind of interesting. End of the second month, began to get on his nerves. By the end of the third month, it was driving him mad. He went out wandering in the woods, found that genie again, said, oh, genie, said, I made a terrible mistake. The genie said, I cannot revoke what I've done. The cupbearer said, but he said, it's awful. Everybody just waits on me. He said, I've forgotten the fun I used to have, the pleasure it was to do things for people, to help people. He said, I can't do anything for anybody anymore. I'd rather be in hell. The genie said, where do you think you've been for these last 90 days? It's great legal profession. The only rent we pay for the space we occupy on this earth is our service to other people. Our service is the only rent we pay. Now, I'm from western Kansas originally, little town of Garden City, born and reared there. Some of you have driven through that part of the state know that another 10 miles on to the west, there's a town called Holcomb, H-O-L-C-O-M-B. Well, I heard when I was a boy a story, there was a farm implement dealer stranded in Holcomb on a Saturday night. Now, there's nothing there but a cafe, a filling station, post office. This man ate supper. He went out, no entertainment, no movies, nothing. He went up to one of the local residents. So what's this town noted for, anyway? Man thought. Then he brightened up and said, you can start right here in Holcomb and go anywhere in the United States from here. That's what I say this morning. We can start, each one of us, at this 104th meeting of the Missouri Bar Association, and we can go anywhere in our lives, anywhere in our professions we desire, if we will have goals, strategies, motivations, know what we're doing, love what we're doing, and believe in what we're doing. There's a law of life as powerful as the law of gravity. Now, what the human mind can conceive and believe, it can achieve. Archimedes, the ancient Greek mathematician, said, give me a lever that is long enough and a fulcrum that is strong enough and a place whereon to stand, and I can lift the very world. Our leverage is our motivation. Our fulcrum is our dedicated commitment. The full ground on which we stand is our belief in the great spiritual truths that we're children of God, brothers and sisters to each other, that a fragment of infinity, a glowing ember of eternity, a spark of the divine indwells the mortal mind, and live by those great old Greek virtues, truth and beauty and goodness, justice. And the justice of a bee goes from flower to flower, gathering nectar, so we are destined one day to voyage from star to star, gathering light. I talked to an 80-year-old man. I asked him what he learned from the living of life. He said, I've learned whatever the disappointments of yesterday, the problems of today, the uncertainties of tomorrow. I've learned that when I cease to grow, I have begun to die. He said, therefore, I've resolved that when I can run forward, I'll run. When I can walk, I'll walk. If I can only crawl, I'll crawl. But I'll continue to move forward in my life. The secret of the psychology of exuberant living is to learn to feast upon uncertainty, to fatten upon disappointment, to enthuse over apparent defeat, to invigorate in the presence of difficulties, to exhibit indomitable courage in the face of immensity, and to exercise unconquerable faith when confronted by the challenge of the inexplicable. In the last act, in the final scene of that great Lerner and Lowe stage production, Camelot, do you remember? King Arthur turns and he speaks these ringing words to a young lad, Tom of Warwick, who has journeyed from afar with idealism surging in his soul to serve as a knight of the Round Table. You will return to your home in England, declares King Arthur. You understand, to grow up and grow old. And for as long as you live, you will remember what I, the king, tell you, and you will do as I command. Each evening from December to December, before you drift to sleep upon your cot, think back on all the tales that you remember of Camelot. Ask every person if he's heard the story, and tell it strong and clear, if he has not, that once there was a fleeting wisp of glory called Camelot. And so as each one of us journeys forth from this great convention, these truths and ideas brimming in our minds, I say let us not contain these inside ourselves, but let's share these things forth with the people we know, the people we love, the people we meet along the way. Ask every person if he's heard this story, and tell it strong and clear if he has not, that life can be wonderful. Life can be exuberant. Life can be joyous. You learn to love life and love people and love your great profession. I thank you. God bless you. Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Well done, Mr. President. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you for inviting me. Oh, I appreciate it. Great joy being here.
I was going to ask Bernie.